Welcome to the Karamcast, episode 18. I am here with my co-host, Amy Lynn Chadwick.
What's up?
It's been a while.
It's been quite a while.
But we won't talk about that too much because whenever I listen to podcasts where they say, well, sorry for the long gap since the last episode, and I'm listening to them in serial form, I never know anyways.
Yeah.
So it's been a while since we did one of these only because 2009 was a very rich year.
Busy, busy.
In experiences and changes.
Implanting.
Yeah, a lot of people went through an awful lot of transition. I mean, it wasn't just us, it wasn't just the people we know. Clearly the world was in a state of transition.
Change.
We sort of went through Obama's first year in the presidency, which I guess a lot of people ended up saying that meant not a lot was happening, but really a lot was happening. The American brand won back a lot of favor, and what that will mean for the bottom line in the long run is a very positive thing.
Yeah. You know those crazy Americans. They always like to diss whatever.
Right, whoever's in command.
Yeah.
And healthcare reform is, in terms of the time capsule nature of all of this, healthcare reform is still sort of being pushed through, but there's a lot of infighting and outfighting and pressure and ulterior motives and so on going on that are slowing the bill down.
I'd love that bill to pass quickly.
It would be nice. Being born in Canada, I can extol the virtues of healthcare that is supported by the government.
Or rub it in.
Yeah, I can rub it in. So 2009, I have a bunch of things that I will likely blog about at theculturepin.com, which is my culture and entertainment and technology blog. But I wanted to talk about some of these points in the podcast because it's tough to write all of that in a short enough format that people will sit in front of their computers and read. Although one of the things on my list is the fact that this Christmas, ebooks outsold real books on Amazon for the first time.
Which I still find crazy. I look at that as if it's a fad. Because yeah, there's nothing like a real book and the smell of the pages and everything.
Sure. I mean, we've talked about that on the podcast, how much we love real books. And I don't know. I don't really know if it means that much. I mean, the publishers are all scrambling and now they're going into battles and litigation and ideas about how to renovate their industry and their business model. But honestly, it's two different things. You know, just because I listen to a song that I get on iTunes doesn't mean I don't go see the band. I mean, they're not the same thing.
Yeah.
Live concerts have been making more money than ever, even though the record industry majors would complain that there's nothing going on.
Nothing.
Tell me a little bit about the things that you went through this year, because it was an amazing year. Some of the things we ended up being able to do together.
Yeah.
Some things we went our separate ways and adventured around. So,
well, where did we last leave off? We went to the NAB. I think we already talked about that. That was amazing. And then I went on to film a part on the TV show, The Forgotten, where I got to act next to Christian Slater.
That was on CBS?
That was on ABC.
On ABC.
Yes.
ABC, who loves making crime shows that have a slightly paranormal or metaphysical tint, and they also like making clones of Lost nowadays, like we saw with Flash Forward.
Where did that go?
It stopped. TV was really weird this year because they found out very quickly that you don't have time anymore on TV to build your story up over 7 or 8 episodes. They kind of had to get to the point or they would get canceled or put on hiatus.
Yeah, like V.
Like V, which made like 4 episodes before they put it on pause. And they said,
I wanted to like that so bad.
Yeah, of course.
Episode 1, I fell asleep.
They were trying too many old techniques, and I don't know what was wrong with V. It was just, what bothered me about V was that they kind of put too much out in the first episode. Mm-hmm. I remember when it aired back in the 80s with Mark Singer and everything, I was terrified when I watched that show. But there was a long period before you really understood that these people, you could rip their faces off and that they were lizards underneath.
Ew.
And in this one, it sort of happened right off the bat. There was no mystery left. And
what's the point of watching it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I filmed The Forgotten.
Yes, and you worked with Christian Slater, who you love.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that was amazing. It was like a waking up inside your dream and being there.
What's it like? What's he like off camera?
Sweetheart. I know a lot of people say that, but no, he was just really real and really nice. He said hello to every single person from the grip to the catering.
So tell me one thing that I wouldn't know if I didn't meet him in person.
Oh, he's funny.
Yeah, he's witty.
Yeah, he made me laugh during one of my scenes a lot.
Good. What, does he have a dry sense of humor? Or is he a clown?
He's a guy.
Oh, he's a dude?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, he seems kind of emo.
I don't know, I didn't get the emo vibe.
Right.
I got the sweetheart vibe.
Cool.
Yeah.
Did you fall in love?
For like a minute. And then once I was done, I got over it.
Right. Like on most jobs. I find that
totally.
Whenever people get on an acting job, they all fall in love and then it's over. And then it's like, what just happened to me?
Yeah, it wasn't that deep.
Right.
It was maybe a millisecond.
Well, that's amazing. Good for you. That was the premiere of the show, right?
Yeah. And I liked my part and it was fun.
And it's still on.
It's still on.
Which is a lot.
it got picked up for, I think, 5 more episodes so
Great.
Far.
That's really good.
And then he just added Alicia Cuthbert to the...
Okay, now, can we talk about this for a second with ABC? What is it with ABC recycling their actors?
I don't know.
Every single show was like the cast of Lost mixed with the cast of, well, Serenity from... which is imported from Fox, but like they just mm-hmm. keep using the same pool of 10 or 15 people and it drives me nuts.
I know. I noticed that this season.
Because
too.
I want those characters to live in those realities, in those worlds, and then all of a sudden I see them playing something else and I feel all
confused.
Violated and confused.
Yeah.
So, okay, so Alicia's on,
yeah,
on
she's
Forgotten
on
now.
The Forgotten now, supposedly.
And on 24,
mm-hmm.
still. She comes back in the new season of 24 when she's in New York or whatever the hell Jack Bauer is doing now.
That's great for people out there who can't get one job. She's got two.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Hook me up with your agent.
So, and then you also shot another film on, well, my inner geek is going to talk about the fact that you shot another film with red cameras.
Red camera, yes. I got to hold that little effer. It's
yeah.
pretty heavy. I loved it. Yeah, that's Cummings Farm. We shot it in Louisiana last year.
And they're shooting a lot of movies in Louisiana because it's actually one of the 3 or 4 states right now that have a 30% tax incentive. So
yeah, and the highest mosquito population I've ever seen in my life.
I heard that there was insane amounts of insects the whole time you were there.
Ugh, I don't even want to get into that.
You were shooting on a bayou or something?
We were shooting, yep, right on the bayou. And one of my scenes was at 5 in the morning. My legs had to be dangling over the bridge on the water.
Yeah, the pier. The
so dock. They're getting ready and I'm holding my legs up shivering because it's freezing out. The second I threw my legs over, I kid you not, 5,000 mosquitoes came flying out from underneath the bridge and I was like, bug spray! Someone get the bug spray! And normally I don't complain on set, but
yeah,
I had to.
It was intense.
I had like 90,000 leprosy.
Not only that, but this year they said there was some crazy surge in the mosquito population mm-hmm. because for the last few years it had been dry.
Yeah.
And so they were all dormant and they're apparently their spawn can chill for a few years.
I noticed that when I went to Toronto too, when you filmed your music video.
Oh, the video. Yeah. We did a music video for my song Fascinating and you were the... unknown.
I was the backdress.
You're the backdress.
Yeah.
The unknown love.
You'll see the back of my head.
But, you know, the mosquitoes were there, but they weren't like you're talking about in Louisiana.
Not as bad.
And you remember those really strange creatures that we saw up
moths.
In northern Ontario?
Yeah, and I grabbed one.
Yeah, they were moths that looked like Tinkerbell.
They were so cute.
They were big enough to look like small birds.
They were the size of a hand. They were like a light fluorescent green. No other colors or markings.
They looked like mice with wings.
So I grabbed one by its wing and I dangled it in your face.
Yeah, but I'd never seen those being up there ever before.
Alien.
So these aliens descended upon Northern Ontario when the mosquito bum rush was happening.
Gosh. So Mosquito Land, yeah. So the movie actually did quite well.
Good.
So far, it got accepted to, and it premiered at the New Orleans Film Festival. Then it went to Austin Film Festival. And now we're going to Slam Dance.
That's amazing.
I'm excited.
How many entries were there?
There was 5,000 people that applied and only 18 got accepted.
So that's huge.
I hope so.
I wonder why your film was chosen and not something else.
Because I'm in it.
Awesome.
No, I think it's a dark, twisted comedy, and the premise of it, you expect it to be something.
What's the premise?
The premise is three couples go to this farm, and they decide to have an orgy. They're all
so
friends.
They're swingers?
No. They're okay. All like normal couples. Oh, okay. They're all going through their different things in their relationships, and they're friends. And they think, this will be good, you know, fix up the relationships, go to this farm, have an orgy.
Is it a porn?
It's not a porn. I don't even think there's any nudity in it.
Okay, so it's like a...
It's really a smart script. Ted Beck wrote it. He also stars in it. And I was really impressed by him. It's this young kid from Austin, Texas area. Mm-hmm. And when I first met him, I didn't really know who he was. And they picked us up from the airport and we went and got some food. And we had to choose the table we were sitting at. And this guy comes in with this little molester mustache. And he sits down next to me. And then I look over for the girls and I got up with my tray and moved to another table.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, it was funny. You had to be there, but...
And that was him.
That was him.
Got it. Good. So that's amazing. I went to UCLA. I went back to UCLA this year to study or finish off a certificate I'd been trying to fill out for business and marketing of film and shooting and film and everything. And we were exposed to a lot of very new information and emotions about the independent film world and how small of a chance an independent has right now to get financed and so on. But it's amazing to hear that there are still people out there making movies for $500,000, shooting them on Red One cameras, which are, you know, $500 a day to rent. That's how you do it. They make the rounds at these festivals. And when Sundance started getting 12,000 to 15,000 entries a year, there was just a huge glut of films that were being overlooked. So things like Slam Dance emerged. And then there's other festivals like Dances with Films, and I don't even know all the names of them. But Slam Dance actually happens in Park City, where Sundance happens, in the same neighborhood, on the same block. So at the same time. So what's amazing is that all of those people are rubbing shoulders together. And in fact, Paranormal Activity, I believe, started off at a small horror festival in New York, but then it made its way to Slam Dance.
Yep.
And this is a movie that was shot by a couple with local, you know, locally available camcorders. I think they used an HV20 at some point, which is my favorite little camcorder.
Mm-hmm.
Not exclusively, but that was one of the cameras they used. And they cut it on Sony Vegas, which is $400 software, which is what I use to cut my videos.
What did they spend, like $15,000?
$15,000. And then they had this social networking campaign where they said, hey, if we can get 1 million signatures or 1 million requests to put this up in theaters, then we'll get a theater distribution limited run. And it worked, and they did. And when the movie came out, it made something like $100 million domestically.
Yeah.
So that was a huge breakout story. Of course, it sounds like a Blair Witch thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was so grassroots. Blair Witch was made for $100,000 or something. This was made for $15,000 on home editing software. Whether you liked it or not, it was a huge success story.
Well, with all the new technology coming out and things that are more available for the amateur, if you will, I think there's a lot of opportunities for people to really create amazing things.
There are a lot more outlets, for sure, yeah. to distribute and to broadcast whatever it is you're making. It's like the music industry. Mm-hmm. There's no central place anymore, so it feels like much more difficult than it used to be. But in fact, there's more ways to be heard than ever before. It's just not going to be concentrated, so it's much more difficult to see or feel or gauge success in the same way that we used to by that bottleneck of numbers. So going through a list, I mean, we've already covered a few of the things on my list that were sort of mind-blowing: Paranormal Activity, ebooks. Talking about cameras, Canon cameras released the 5D Mark II a little while back, about a year and a bit ago, and that camera was loved for its enormously good quality and the fact that it could shoot high-definition video in a DSLR camera.
Now, didn't you just get a present from Santa?
Well, I did. But before I get to that, the thing about the Mark II that was so cool was that you could put on professional lenses and switch them around, which is what gives things a very cinematic look. Mm-hmm. The problem was that the Mark II didn't shoot 24 frames per second, which is what film look is to people. That's what we associate with the look of film. The camera was used to shoot the very first presidential portrait ever on a digital camera. And a popular science magazine called it the gadget of the year, bar none. Like, not some rocket ship or jetpack, but they called this camera the product of the year. So then shortly after, a lot of complaints from the users, you know, why doesn't this camera shoot 24 frames and so on? Canon made their user-defined version, improved camera, which is called the 7D. And the 7D has a huge sensor for capturing light. It's much larger than a normal camcorder. It can have interchangeable lenses, and the thing costs $1,600. And knowing how to use it properly and adding the right tools to it, you really are getting close to a RED camera in terms of quality, which the only difference is that a RED camera shoots video in a raw format, which is a huge sized format. The 7D does not. It shoots in a slightly compressed format, which is a QuickTime format. Anyways, I won't get into all those details, but the amazing thing is, if you go on Google or Vimeo or YouTube and look up Canon 7D and see what people are shooting with this, you will absolutely be amazed.
That thing you showed me the other day that someone shot on a Canon 7D blew my mind.
Because of its size, there's little tiny portable dollies that you can, when I mean a dolly, I mean a small rail that you can slide the camera along. So your production value can be huge for very little money. Speaking of online video, another thing that happened this year that was sort of a flag post was U2 played a concert that was shot in high definition and it was streamed live over the internet and millions of people watched it live. That's also going to be a 3D concert later on. And they were shooting this really innovative 3D style.
Was that with that microphone that came down that was
with the lasers? And,
yeah.
They used some very bleeding edge technology in the way that they shot this. But I guess the point is that people were all able to participate in this concert experience all over the world in real time. Which, and that's a huge thing.
It's never been done before.
No, not on that scale, not at that level of quality.
Yeah.
And Avatar, James Cameron's film, his lifelong dream project, finally...
I haven't seen it yet. Don't tell me about it.
Well, finally came to the screens. And, you know, we've always loved the idea of 3D on this podcast and going and what it's going to be. But Avatar really, really raised the bar. People go to see Avatar and they say, wow, it's so lifelike and it's so beautiful and it's so rich and the story's kind of meh or whatever. And it's going to make $1 billion before the month is over. But what they may not know about Avatar is the way that it was created is the first time it's been done this way. What they did was they shot the actors with all of the sensors and the motion capture stuff. Then they went off and they rendered all the 3D environments and the way that these characters would look. And then the part that's really groundbreaking is that James Cameron then lifted up this little monitor thing, like a viewer, and where he would swing it was where the camera essentially would be shooting. So it was like he was in that 3D world and able to move the camera around to shoot whatever he wanted to. As opposed to the old days where animation, you know, everything is very, very staged and you create just what you're going to be looking at. James Cameron was able to build the universe that he wanted to be in.
His own virtual reality.
Yeah, and then film it the way that a director would hope to catch the action as it happened.
Wow.
And that's why this movie will look like nothing else that's come before. As a result, all of the competitors, the so-called competitors, including Pixar and Steven Spielberg and everything, can now, you know, are now coming out and saying there's no way that they can avoid the fact that that's been done. So now they're all basically turning to that technology and that method that James Cameron developed and saying, okay, we want to do things, or we have to do things that way.
Right. Jump on the bandwagon.
So that was a big one for 2009. That was a real game changer. That was a moment in history that we'll look back in 100 years and say that was the beginning.
Well, we talked about 3D like a bunch of squealing school children last year, right?
You know, that, and this is a conversation that's been going on for a decade. I mean, longer, with the film studios, who said, you know, if we make 3D, is that going to force people to go back to the theaters? Not force, but really encourage them, because it's something you can only experience there. But when we go to NAB this year in 2010, 3D TVs are already going to be in the homes.
Yeah.
And again, I'm going to say this for the last time on this podcast. Listeners, you may not believe me, but in 2010, 3D TV in your home will be as common as a Nintendo Entertainment System was in the 80s.
Yeah. I look back at the last year, and all the things I heard about at NAB are now in fruition. I think it's cool.
Google announced via a live webcast as well, they announced real-time search. Mm-hmm. And people may think, oh, well, I've always been able to go on Google and get search results right away. But that's not what we're talking about. In the olden times, back when dinosaurs walked the earth, Google bots, which were these little pieces of code, would crawl around the internet and they would look at things and they would say, okay, what is this about? Who's linking to it? How important is it? And then you would get your search results based on that. And that would happen over the course of a month. So search results could be about a month old when, by the time you were looking at them.
Way back then.
Way back. Yeah. Like pterodactyls, Tyrannosaurus Rex, the whole thing.
Woolly mammoths.
Woolly mammoths. I'm pretty sure those did not exist in the same period. But, you know, you get the idea. Yeah. Long, long ago. Mm-hmm. Before deodorant, basically. Right. And then they shortened that, of course, to, you know, weekly and then daily and then hourly and then minutes. And now, just at the end of 2009, they came out and said, Google is proud to announce real-time search. That means when you go to google.com/trends, T-R-E-N-D-S, and this won't matter by the time you hear it because it'll be everywhere. When you type in a search, you will see scrolling results underneath the different results that are what's happening right this moment in time. So if somebody tweets it, if somebody posts a Facebook update or a MySpace thing or whatever, those results are showing up as they happen.
Yeah.
That is crazy. Because why is it crazy? It's not crazy that Google can display that information. It's that Google can prioritize and filter that information to say, of these, this is the most relevant or coming from the most reliable source.
Does it happen regional or
localized?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. And Google is going to be moving into a lot of highly customizable and targeted things like that, where your phone and its GPS and its location is going to mean a lot more to people in the coming year. Speaking of Google and
location,
mm-hmm. Time Magazine called Google's Android the device of the year.
Oh, people love it.
Which is crazy because it wasn't the iPhone with its billion apps, which were a huge new industry this year. Apps for the iPhone were something that actually caught the business world kind of off guard. They didn't realize every one of these apps is actually a small business unto itself. It's not just one company that makes a whole bunch of apps that are, you know, 99 cents, but that each one of those apps can literally turn into hundreds of thousands of dollars, but they're not yet.
Right.
Despite all of that, it was the Android, which is Google's phone operating system.
The Android.
It's actually called Android, Droid was Motorola's specific device.
Got it.
And by far the most popular of them. But Android, the big difference is that it doesn't charge you for those apps. It says, hey, anybody who wants to make one can make one and come on down and load it up and pretty much will work with anything. And unlike Apple, where it's a very closed system and it has to be approved by Apple and it has to be sanctioned by Apple, and there was all kinds of fights this year about Apple not approving certain apps, you know, from Nine Inch Nails to Google Talk. The Android doesn't care. It's like, if you want to try it out, stick it on your phone and away you go.
Right.
Regardless of that, though, RIM, which makes BlackBerry, was still the largest of the companies. It was the most profitable.
Well, BlackBerries are the best.
I was surprised to hear that. But that's probably going to get evened
because
out a lot.
Because BlackBerries, as much as they do, they don't get into all of the extra stuff, like the apps, the add-on stuff. So it doesn't get too confusing. It's more for business.
It's a familiar interface. There is a lot to be said for simplicity.
Yeah.
And reliability and consistency.
Wow.
I think Robert Scoble complained about the fact that when he got his Android, he just couldn't figure out the depth of it all. You know, it was like three or four different steps to get to do the most basic, obvious things that he wanted to do. So I can see how that can become frustrating.
Well, yeah, it takes time. But I wouldn't mind a Droid. I wouldn't mind to check it out.
Yeah, it's cool to walk around with a handheld computer.
But I love my BBM.
We also bombed the moon.
We bombed the moon.
A great film came out called Moon, starring Sam Rockwell, which was a little tiny independent.
Kind of like artistic film.
A baby version of Kubrick's 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw it on your own.
I did, all by myself.
And you loved it.
I thought it was very beautiful.
That's what I got from all my friends.
Yeah.
I
thought he did a phenomenal job. What a great actor.
So Moon comes out, and it's about isolation, right, on the moon and daydreams and sort of existentialism. And then that same year, NASA and JPL, I believe, basically launched a bomb at the moon to blow it up and see if water would come up. And the results were, as everybody knows now, kind of like when Geraldo went into Al Capone's vault. But over the course of that month, they did start to see that there were signs of condensation and water particles and so on. And big deal. We're sort of back where we started. I just thought it was... I felt really personally...
Invaded.
Invaded.
Like, I did too.
What right do you have to go and bomb the moon that I love and adore so much?
Well, I just remember waking up and reading someone's status update. We're going to bomb the moon today. And I was like, haha, funny. And then I saw it on the news.
Did you have for a second the same vision of terror that I had? That maybe what if it goes wrong
and
it breaks in half and chunks come flying down?
This is it. This is the moment we've all been dreading.
And then I realized... Yet again, here I am with my human hubris thinking that we have the ability to blow the moon up into chunks.
Heck, but we had sonic booms this year, too. Remember that?
Yeah. Really strange, mysterious sonic booms that would rattle windows and set off car alarms, but that the geophysicists couldn't explain and the aeronautics people couldn't explain.
That stuff freaks me out.
Yeah, man. Freaks me out. Freaks me out. Disney, speaking of freaks me out, Disney bought Marvel Comics. They bought Marvel Studios. I mean, that really scared me because
Disney shouldn't be buying Marvel.
Well, I was in a film, as you know, from Marvel called Punisher Warzone, which was clearly nothing that Disney could ever, ever put out. And people argued, no, but they have Touchstone and, you know, they can do sort of edgier material. I just feared that the same thing would happen to Marvel Comics that happened to the Muppets, which is they just became so gentrified and drab. Don't get me wrong. Disney makes some incredible things. Also, keep in mind that Steve Jobs personally owns about a 6% share in Disney now because of Pixar. And Pixar owns a major part of Disney's bottom line now, something like 33% or more. So it's not really the Disney of, you know, the Ukrainian dude who had a dream. And
it's a monopoly.
I'll be interested in seeing what Disney and Marvel together mean. In the long run, it's going to be a great investment for Disney. That's a huge intellectual property to mine for years and years and years. It'll just be a softer, gentler Marvel. Mm. I went to Hawaii, and then I brought you out to see me.
Yeah, I went to Hawaii.
I was shooting an indie. I was acting in an independent film, which, much like your film, Cummings Farm, this one was called One Kind Day, but it was also shot on red cameras. The budget was probably in the same ballpark, between $500,000 to $1.5 million. And it was great. What a great experience. I got to go to Hawaii for 5 weeks.
What a perfect job.
I felt, you know, the worst part about it was that everybody kept reminding me how spoiled and lucky I was. When you can't get any sympathy,
come on.
You know, and you're waking up at 3 a.m. to go to work. And
in a Zen palace.
And it's 112 degrees out and it's humid. And my character, who's a total howly, is like wearing full-length black jeans and layered shirts in the heat. But it was a dream job.
That was incredible.
And the cameras kept overheating and over-humidifying.
Oh, no.
And right at the end...
Didn't you have a storm?
There was that
something?
Hurricane
oh, yeah.
that was coming, and we thought, okay, where are the nearest shelters? And I had like 2 days left after 5 weeks.
I was getting the updates via Twitter.
I was pretty scared. I got to tell you, I was pretty freaked out. I've been in some dodgy places and through some strange weather patterns in my life, but I was like, I'm on this island. They're shuttering everything up right now, and there's no way off of this island.
I started praying for you. I got a little nervous.
And then we were fine. It just completely missed the islands, and... it was all good. But it really made me think about those places that do get hit by hurricanes and tornadoes and typhoons. And and it bothered me that, you know, after a few days, the news stops reporting on those places and those people are left there. And really occurred to me from the inside out how absolutely terrifying and desperate those situations can be.
Yeah.
And when there's no support and there's no drinking water and there's dead animals floating around outside your window, I mean, it's a horrific and... it's a terrible experience, and it really put me on the other side of that possibility.
Well, I'm glad you came back.
Thanks.
On a happier note, what was your favorite meal or food that you experienced in Hawaii?
Oh, we had a really fun time. I was writing about that on my blog, the Taste Odyssey blog, because we liked spam sushi.
Loved. I brought one home on the plane.
AKA musubi. And the spam sushi is obviously a hangover from the wartime.
Whatever, you know,
the wartime
presents, delicious.
The canned meat. Mm-hmm. And they would serve that warm, and you could get it at 7-Elevens. You love shave ice.
Shave ice. I got so excited and then got so sad when I came back to LA and I wanted shave ice and you were still in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was texting you and all of a sudden this truck drives by and it says, "Get shaved. LA's number one shave ice truck." Like the Kogi barbecue truck?
Yep.
I got so excited. I started going 100 miles per hour on the 101 following this thing. Perfect. Perfect.
They even have snow caps?
Snow caps.
So a shave ice is just shaved ice. Ugh. And they put flavored syrups on it. And then a snow cap is when they put like a condensed milk sort of layer on the very top of it. Delicious.
It was like $2.50 for this huge, massive bowl of love.
Yeah. Then, great. Okay, so wait, let's get through the rest of the year. So quickly, We went to the Indiecade in Culver City. Indiecade, actually, the next podcast episode, I have a very cool exclusive interview with a couple of guys who are starting a new independent video game label called The Singularity. And Indiecade was where I met them, and it was a festival for independent video game makers. And we were exposed to some incredible ideas, very innovative, very forward-thinking, much more abstract than Mario Brothers and Frogger.
Gosh, it was so artsy.
It was.
A good way.
Yeah, there's this new medium that allows independent musicians and designers and painters and storytellers to all work in creating this interactive medium. You know, film was always that, where you had a hugely collaborative medium, but independent video games do that as well. Mm-hmm. Sure, there's the giant video games like Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, which came out and made $500 million in one day.
No.
The biggest entertainment opening day of anything ever.
Oh my God. I can believe it though.
But then you come down to this level where people are doing it in their bedrooms and using their imagination, and really there's the sky's the limit in terms of what the content can be. And because you can go online, you can play a lot of these things for free. They're flash games or they're just downloads for free. And now you're
or
starting to see.
Or they're browser-based.
Or they're browser-based. And I really urge you, the listener, to not just dismiss the idea that video games aren't your thing and look into independent video games in this time and age, because it's a really exciting, very artistic, very thought-provoking new scene that's happening. And I don't know how long it'll be before it starts to, again, become sort of homogenous, the way that indie music as a term started to make everything sound like it was the Christmas pageant opening mixed with Velvet Underground. But indie games right now are very fresh. The subject matter is very wide. So Indiecade, and then we went to the HD Expo in Burbank and we saw mind-blowing 3D TVs that you could stand like right at the side of. I'm talking like 180-degree viewing angle.
Yeah, that was a huge leap from being at NAB a few months prior, and they had those TVs there, and you'd had to sit in a certain spot, and you couldn't go side to side. But this one, no matter where I went, it still looked fine.
It had an amazing viewing angle. And we were actually, incidentally, watching a U2 concert in 3D. I think it was that U2 concert I was referring to.
Yeah.
And it looked incredible. It was just a rich, deep, very wide viewing angle.
It was crazy.
So next NAB 2010, we'll be there. We'll be reporting. I'll have my Canon 7D camera to shoot it with.
I'll have my notepad.
And hopefully you'll have a Kodak ZI-8.
Yeah.
Which I'm telling you is better than the Flip Minnow for a little pocket-sized HD video camera. It's like $170.
Yeah, I just want one. That way I can document it, put up some vids with the pod.
Yeah. So one last thing. Iran had a huge collision of ideas this year when, after an election, the results felt as though they were rigged to go towards the party that was not the popular vote. And they took to the streets and protested. Let's recall that the population of Iran is primarily within the mid-20s. I would say about 80% of the population are people between 20 and 30 years old. And they took to the streets, and the media shut them down and shut down global media. So they deferred to Twitter. And Twitter became almost one of the singular sources of real information, to the point where then there were parties that were trying to jam Twitter. And there was a counter effort by Twitterers in North America that were making it seem as though they were sending tweets from within Iran to basically confuse these jammers. And it was an amazing ordeal. But Twitter, which I've spoken about before and sort of evangelized, really came into its own in 2009.
Yeah.
And
around April, I think.
Google,
it was.
Microsoft, everybody started paying a license to use the Twitter API in their search results. And Facebook, which now has 350 million users, totally revamped its interface to reflect the Twitter style of updates.
Hacks.
So, again, I don't know exactly how Twitter will look to us in 2010, but it has irrevocably changed the way that people interact with information online. It really did come in and leave its mark.
Yeah, and I think if you're following the right people, you'll definitely see that.
Yeah. If you go on there for the popularity contest, it's going to be very difficult and challenging.
Very grim.
But as far as the young kids, and we found out that the young kids these days are listening to their music on a Bluetooth single ear headphone. So they're not even listening to music in stereo anymore. They're listening to it in mono, which makes me think I'm just going to record my next album on my dictaphone and throw it up on like Lala.
I want to record something on a dictaphone.
That's just too dirty for the...
Oh.
Thank you guys for hanging in, and we're excited to be back in our new studio.
I know. It looks great in here.
Thank you. I like the waterfall. Do you like the live panther in the corner?
I was just going to say the panther's nice, but the orangutan in the corner has stolen my heart.
And there's the shave ice bar.
I know. Free mimosas.
I'm going to go chill out in the indoor pool and bring me a Mai Tai, would you?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
We ran out of umbrellas.
And we'll see you in the next episode where we talk to the guys from IndieCade and more about independent video games. And have an awesome new year.
Yeah, happy 2010.
And we'll see you guys in Stanley Kubrick's 2010.
Peace.